Hey, you're listening to Blindsight. Let's go. Mental health isn't something to take lightly. It's time to fight. It's time to thrive. Let's do this.
Welcome to Blindsight. I'm your host, Bill Lundgren, and my co-host is holding down the control room today, so it's just going to be me and my guest, which should be a lot of fun. And I want to welcome you to Blindsight and this series that we're starting today, which is taking in the 12 steps of AA. And we'll be each week for the next 12 weeks, we will be taking one step at a time, having different people explain the meaning of the step to them and to others. And I think it would be very educational. And I want to let people know, yes, it's focused on alcoholism in terms of being Alcoholics Anonymous 12 steps. But the whole picture, as I tried to explain in the podcast last week, that it really is a life thing that we're talking about, how we make our lives manageable. And today's session is step one and talks about unmanageability and recognizing it and what we do. And so I'm really delighted to introduce my guest today, Jeff Slund. And Jeff is working at the Betty Ford Center in California. He's actually broadcasting from California. And he has been there for a while. If you recognize the name of Betty Ford, yes, it's the wife of our former president, Gerald Ford. And she was very instrumental in creating it. And she was very active at the Betty Ford Center in terms of working with patients there, and has made the program has quite a wonderful reputation. And I'm just delighted to have Jeff, who besides being a guest, he's also a personal friend. And that makes it even more fun for me to have him on. Jeff, welcome.
Thank you, Bill. It's so good to be here. And I'm just super excited to be a part of this. So thank you so much.
Well, it's my pleasure. What I'd like to do to start off is to have you read the first step.
Certainly. Okay, step one. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable.
Pretty simple.
Yeah.
But there's a lot more to it. And I'm going to ask you, Jeff, to tell me your thoughts about that first step.
You know, I recently celebrated 22 years of sobriety on January 1st of this year. And the whole concept of being powerless, you know, prior to actually getting sober, I had started my journey in recovery back in 1996. So I had started, I'm from Cleveland. I had done some treatment there, and I had always done like the first three steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I, you know, step one, I admitted I was powerless, check. I always check the steps off, especially number one, because yeah, okay, I'm powerless, but I never really thought about it and actually got honest about my powerlessness. I had not to make this a long drunkalogue or going back in time, but really starting in college is when my drinking really took off. And looking back, I had been powerless over alcohol probably from day one of my drinking. I just never got honest about it. And it really wasn't until I came out to Betty Ford or came out to California and did treatment in 2003 that I really looked at it. And that's not to say that the other treatments I had participated in or the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous I attended weren't successful or weren't good treatment or meetings. It just means that I really wasn't getting honest with myself about what powerlessness meant to me. I had lost jobs. I had lost relationships. I had lost really some family relationships, but yet it still never thoroughly hit home with me about how powerless I was over alcohol until actually like 23 or in 2003 when I actually looked at that and it was like an epiphany that I am truly powerless over alcohol. And if I take a drink, I mean, I will just lose absolutely everything. I think for me, it was, you know, like I had said, just checking off the boxes, Bill.
Yeah.
And as a therapist, you know, that with the, you know, box checking doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
So.
Well, we can intellectually, accept. But until it gets to the gut, to the emotion, and say, yes, I really, and that's what you're calling honesty, is emotionally saying, I am truly powerless. And that's what it takes. I know, to use a different analogy, Mark Twain always said, it's easy for me to give up cigars. I've done it thousands of times.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, the kind of thing that we get into in a lot of our habits. We say, oh, you know, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, or whatever. But we never come to, or we have difficulty coming to the idea, I can't do it. It's just not an option.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and, you know, it's like quitting smoking cigars 1,000 times. I quit drinking 1,000 times, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whenever I got into a pickle or got arrested, I mean, calling it a pickle, you know, getting arrested, a DUI, these are all horrible things, but it was, oh, I'm so powerless over alcohol, but yet I still, without being honest about myself or with myself, it would be, oh, I'm powerless over it, but I'm still going to go get a bottle and drink today.
Yeah, and try tonight. It out. Try it. See if I really am powerless. Yeah. It's the trial and error that finally gets us to the point of saying, you know, it won't work.
No. And it, you know, in the beginning it works until it doesn't, right?
Yeah.
And
exactly. Exactly.
And I just tried to make it work.
Well,
for a very long time. And it was just broken.
What really helped you to get honest about it?
I had done treatment back in Cleveland. I had gone to some wonderful programs there, and then when I came out to Betty Ford, I think what really happened was I finally got honest with me. I finally got honest with Jeff. And it wasn't your fault. It wasn't my boss's fault. It wasn't the world's fault. It's really about admitting and surrendering, which we're incorporating other steps here. But it's really about getting honest with myself. And when that happened, like I say, it was an epiphany, and it wasn't, you know, angels and archangels singing, but it was like, holy smokes, this is serious, and this if I drink again, then I literally will die. And I came into treatment without a job, without, I was probably going to get kicked out of my parents' house. I was really, without knowing it, at the end of everything. You know, I think everybody had just given up on me. And to be honest, fortunately for my, my oldest sister and her husband put me, arranged for me to go to Betty Ford or for treatment. And, I received excellent treatment back then. And my counselor was, to be honest, he was, I will be forever thankful. He was honest. He was caring. He was compassionate, but he told me the truth. And no one had ever told me the truth before or had been honest with me. And to be honest, it was sort of a what is it, Bill? A hard pill to swallow.
Yep.
But when you realize the truth, it's like, wow, this guy laid it on the line. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, now the rest, now it's time for me to follow the people that have gone before me, because they're sober now. And this is what I want. It's like when I first started the journey, I wanted everything that the people at the meetings had. They had jobs, they had homes, they had nice cars, they were laughing, they were happy. I just didn't want to do the work.
Yeah.
And without work, it's for, wishing and hoping is not going to get you
anything. Well, what did it feel like when you called it an epiphany, when you're truly honest with yourself? Is there some secret formula that says, now I can be honest with myself, that it may be our listeners to, can maybe not go as long as you did? What do you think it takes to, is it the family kicking you out? Is it, what do you think is the secret of getting honest?
I wish I could tell you this secret, but unfortunately, it took what it took. And looking back at all the help, at the prior treatment, the counselors I've had, starting, actually, there was a woman named Clarice in Cleveland at Rosary Hall, who was phenomenal. She was just a wonderful counselor. But you know what? I wasn't ready. I just didn't want to hear it. I didn't want to listen. Mm-hmm. I wasn't ready to. So I think until we're actually, or someone is really ready to at least be willing to hear something, then it kind of falls on deaf ears. And we have to just fully surrender. And that's where the whole, the whole powerlessness comes for me into play in others. And if I can add that, I talk with family members. I talk with patients, or future patients, or people that call me that are struggling with alcohol and or drugs. I'll talk about surrendering or powerlessness. And there are people that will say, well, I don't want to be powerless because I want to be powerful. Right. And being powerless is being weak. And I'm not here to argue with someone when they call me. And it's like, well, no, powerless is just surrendering and being open to.
Well, I think that's a good point. I think that people, the idea of powerlessness and that they don't have any power at all. To be perfectly honest, I can tell you I did the exact same thing in that, but I had to go into a blackout Yeah. And then I realized, oh, I really am powerless over this.
Yeah.
That was my epiphany, if you will. And when somebody told me what was happening, and I seemed totally conscious, but one of the things we keep trying to figure out how to help people to understand when, A, that being powerless is actually a positive when we decide that we're not going to fight whatever we demand of ourselves, that we can't do it, and it's okay. But number two, to convince people that, you know, it comes, particularly with alcohol, there comes a time when you are powerless no matter what you do, because that's an intellectual process. And to have people really get in their gut and say, I can't do this anymore.
Exactly, exactly. And I think admitting that you're powerless, or, you know, again, for me, admitting I was powerless actually gave me the power of the strength.
Power, yeah. It's contradictory.
So it's kind of a contradiction of terms. You're powerless to deal with your addiction, your alcoholism, and it actually empowers. It empowered me.
It empowers
because
you.
Because now, you know, when you know, I talk to. You know, I talk to, and so do you with your your clients and just people in general, and it you know, they say, well, you know, I cannot drink, I just can't drink anymore, or I can't drink today, and the thing is, I mean, I being a sober man, a person in recovery, yeah, you know what, Bill, I actually could drink today. I just choose not to.
There you go.
So when people will say, oh, I cannot drink ever again, it's like, well, that's never again is a long time for me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And if I can just literally deal with this day, with Friday, that's really all I really need to be concerned with. But the thing is for me that I can't drink. Yes, I can drink. I just choose not to today. And that's the powerful component, I think, of Alcoholics Anonymous,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
That we do have choices, and that empowers us
we can
make these choices.
And we say, and what people say in the program is one day at a time, which I think is crucial. So
right.
We can't say, you're not going to think about, oh, I'll never be able to drink. You say, today I will not drink. And that's what starts with this understanding how powerless we are, and that our life has become unmanageable.
Yeah.
And it's the unmanageability that we have to address. And the unmanageability says to us, you know, something's got to change.
Right. You know, and the unmanageability, I mean, I mean, I don't know what's going to happen next week or tomorrow, for that matter. But I can deal with, you know, again, one day at a time, like you said, right?
Right.
So you and I can deal with today and whatever happens.
Mm-hmm. But we can't predict the future. We just stay with where we are, and we also have to begin to think about, okay, if I can't do anything, what do I do next? And that's where the second step comes in. But we have to, you know, say, okay, this is it. It isn't that I can't drink forever, is what I'm hearing you say. I just choose not to drink today.
Right.
And tomorrow. And, you know, whatever it is. And because alcoholism particularly is prone to relapse.
Yeah.
And that's not the end of everything if that happens. It just means you get back on the horse.
Well, right. And hopefully you can, and people do. You know, I mean, there's no shame in admitting a relapse. It's not reaching out for help that's unfortunate.
What do you think people, let's say they make the decision that they're powerless and their life has become unmanageable? One of the things that happens is everybody tries to say, okay, now I've done this, I'm going to try to change the entire world. And it's kind of like, you know, we go to the other extreme. We want to, you know, now we've, you know, started this and we're going to, you know, go to 500 meetings in 3 days and whatever. And then they get exhausted and then, you know, then the will disappears.
Right.
And, you know, I like the idea of being able to go and be with other people who are struggling through the same thing. But some of us have a little trouble with that.
You mean with going to meetings?
Going to meetings, right, right.
Well, it's well, because I'm not like those other people,
yeah.
Bill. I'm special, I'm different, and they don't understand me, and I'm maybe I'm not as bad as they
there
are.
You go. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the way we right? tend to rationalize, yeah.
You know.
Or maybe the unmanageability is them. Not as bad as we thought it is.
Right. Right. It's interesting. And you were talking about the people that you know, admitted they were powerless and they're going to all these meetings and now they're going to change the world and they're out to help everyone and I'm going to show you how to do it.
Right. They want to rewrite,
you know,
the
paper. I'm going to show you because I have, you know, 10, 15 days under my belt.
Right.
Now I'm an expert at it. And the thing is, when you talk to people when I talk to people in long-term recovery, it's like, you know, just being with the, you know, the whole honesty of the program saying, well, you know, some days I have good days, I have bad days, and not every day is perfectly executed, if you will, you know, but that's okay. But it's just, if we can just be the best person that we can for that day, I think that's the what we should hope for.
Do you have any sense of what from your experience of what the family needs to do in terms of maybe helping people to understand it's unmanageable or to just back off? And, you know, we talk about intervention as one way, but, you know, what the people who are watching this happen, what should they be doing?
Well, I think family members or loved ones of an alcoholic need to do their own recovery. And I think either getting involved in some kind of family support, maybe a family program, or there's Al-Anon, which
right.
is really a great support system, giving the tools to the family member to help them deal with, well, really it that's for, you know, that that's giving them the tools for themselves, because they're literally powerless over the actions and what the alcoholic is going to do. You know, they're powerless over the person saying, oh, I'm never going to drink again and I'm going to be better and I'm going to show up for work and the family and et cetera, et cetera. But they need to have their tools, their ammunition for when perhaps it doesn't. You know, there's the support of Al-Anon, I believe. You know, and also NAMI, they have the family-to-family programs. They have the peer-to-peer programs. So I think there are so many different available resources out there that are free and available for everyone. So well, there's what really I hear you there's no excuse not to seek help.
Well, what I hear you saying is the family members need to get their act together. They have to admit that, I mean, this is what Lois W. discovered when she threw her slippers at Bill W. as he was going off to a meeting. She said, I'm powerless over him. And I am powerless over this anger that I feel. And so she took the 12 steps and created Al-Anon for the family members, that the family members are not focused on the alcoholic. They're focused on their part, on themselves and taking care of themselves. And hopefully the alcoholic wakes up and realizes, wait a minute, I can't create chaos in this family because they're taking care of themselves. And, you know, and I have to manage myself because I can't blame her or blame him or whatever. They discover, no, I have to focus on me because they're not going to get caught up in it. And that's one of the beauties of it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, alcoholism, addiction, it's such a family disease that you're absolutely right. The family needs to take care of themselves and get their own tools. You know, oftentimes the family will say, "Well, it's his. You know, he's the alcoholic. He's the one that needs the help. I'm good," quote unquote. And that's not always the case.
Right. I mean, absolutely.
It's with someone getting sober and in recovery, it's not a guarantee that everything's going to be hunky dory and all rosy and everything's going to be fine here out. I mean, the family dynamics or the relationship dynamics, I mean, it can be complicated, and everyone really needs their own recovery for themselves to remain healthy.
Well, I had a situation where I was working with a couple, and the husband was getting sober, and as he was getting sober, she was getting a little agitated, and you know, they stopped working with me. And she divorced her husband and married, and I gather from the grapevine that she married another alcoholic because she needed that dynamics. And that's what, you know, gets really the unmanageability on both parts.
Right.
And that's...
I mean, you may have... And that happens, right? That happens often, I mean, or often. You know, you may have an enabler who complains about the alcoholic, but yet when the alcoholic gets sober, now that person doesn't have the control over the alcoholic anymore. So that relationship disintegrates, and actually the spouse or the other half of the relationship really wants the person to stay sick. Because that gives them the power over them. I mean, it's really a convoluted, sad situation. And
so everybody in the picture needs to get healthy.
Absolutely.
And part of the unmanageability. Now, the alcoholic, when he's going through the first step, has to understand his or her part of the problem. And in a sense, leave it up to the other family members to make their decision about how to get themselves healthy. And it's kind of, it feels a little uncomfortable, you know, in terms of I have to say to my family, you know, you've got to get your act together while I'm doing that. But that's exactly what has to happen if you're really honest with what's going on.
Absolutely.
What?
And everybody, like you say, needs to get their act together. But, you know, the alcoholic needs to, you know, admit the powerlessness, work the steps. And you know, if I can just interject this, which I absolutely loved, I heard this in a meeting when I first got sober, I mean, years ago. And the woman was saying, we only have 12 steps. It's not like we have 400 steps to go through. You know, it's like, hey, Bill, what step are you on? I'm on step 286.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, you say, oh, I'm on 312 or something. But it's like, you know, if you think about it, you know, Bill Wills, you know, they made it with only 12 steps. So there's a reason we do them in order.
Yeah.
And really, you know, step one, I mean, you've got to, you know, when people say you just do step one and you've got to admit the powerlessness. So I find it could be a lot worse. We could have a lot more steps to have to deal with. But I think.
But what do you think, you know, if you're saying, you know, coming to the end of this particular segment, but what do you think would be your passionate word to someone who's listening who may, in fact, be willing to look at the unmanageability and look at the first step? What do you think that he or she needs to hear?
Well, you know, I think if people could reach out to someone who is in recovery or who understands the recovery process and really get honest with what's going on with them and hear some of the options. You know, there's not only one way to get sober, right? I mean, there are different ways to skin this cat, and it's really just talk to someone, you know, like you know, it's like doing a 12-step call, you know, it's like someone's reaching out for help, and really just talking and listening to the person, to what they need and what they're willing to do, and hopefully offer them suggestions, and frankly, take them to a meeting. You know, that's the old school of saying, gee, you know, I'd like to know where there's a good meeting today. And it's like, you know what? I've got time. I'll pick you up. I'll pick you up at X time, 12 o'clock, and take you to a meeting. And really just expose people to the 12 steps, to you know, Alcoholics Anonymous has been around for obviously a long time. And the reason it has is because it works.
It works, yeah.
And, you know, it's what, it, you know, people say, you know, keep it simple. And again, there are only 12 steps, but we can complicate things. But I think having someone reach out to a professional such as yourself, you know, who can help guide the person with some options about getting help, just taking that first step, Bill.
Yeah.
Right?
So in other words, that taking that first step is, you know, it seems like it's a solo job, but what you're saying, following through on that step that you've taken or the recognizing its unmanageability is greatly helped if you bring in or have some people who've been there, been through it, to go on the journey to manageability with you.
Right. You know, and you know, when someone will get my phone number and call and say, hey, I need help, I don't know what to do, it's like, well, first of all, you know, I tell them, thanks for picking up that 100-pound phone, right?
Right.
And making that phone call, because if it were easy, everyone would get sober.
Right.
And but when you pick up that phone and reach out for help, and the other person on the line, it's like that's huge. But again, like you say, making the call is, I think, very brave and scary. and it's a wonderful thing. But then you, like you say, you've got to follow through with that.
Right.
Without action, it doesn't work.
But I think the thing, particularly for the blindness community, I have a feeling that there, you know, with some people at least, become very, they don't think, say, an AA group would welcome somebody who isn't sighted, or they don't know how to find a meeting. And I tell people, you know, check with the phone company for intergroup, and they'll get you to AA, and many AA intergroup have directories of programs that are accessible. So you can find a group that's going to be welcoming to you. They're going to understand. And most importantly, it'll be safe for you to go. The other thing, of course, is that I tell people that the Library of Congress Talking Books has the AA, the big book, and a number of other pieces of Alcoholics Anonymous literature on audio tape. So, you know, if you want to find out more about AA or whatever, and you're blind, contact the your Talking Book Library, and they will send you tapes of the books that you can begin to really understand it, and, you know, and help you to kind of bridge the scariness of going with a group of people you don't know.
Yeah.
This has been great. I appreciate it. Do you have any last words you want to give our listeners in terms of if they're thinking about the things that we've been sharing with them?
You know what? It's just reach out. I mean, Bill, you've given some great resources for your listeners. You know, I think you can reach out to the Betty Ford Center. You can reach out. I mean, personally, you could actually reach out to me. There are so many different resources that are available. I mean, I literally would, you know, I've been given the gift of recovery because someone picked up the phone when I needed the help, and I am more than willing to give out my number. I don't know if that's allowed, but I am more than willing to, you know, help someone just find some resources, because again, you know, there is the big book on audio tape. It's available in Braille. It's there are so many different meetings everywhere. There are virtual meetings. So please don't. I mean, I know sometimes we can feel so alone,
right?
And nobody understands me, and there's no one like me in those meetings. But the thing is, as you know, there are. And when you walk into a meeting or go to a meeting, you actually meet someone who's exactly going through the same things you are. And it's to me, that just gives me hope.
Yes.
And comfort. And, you know, if there's anything I can do, or, you know, I don't want this to be a commercial for the Betty Ford Center, but if there's anything, and I really
don't,
but it's about reaching out for help. Please don't, we're here to help you. This is, you know, Mrs. Ford created this because someone helped her, right? Just like so many others. And whether you're blind or you have other disabilities, there's so many people that we all have something that we need help with.
We need to realize that we don't have to do it alone.
Absolutely.
People are more than happy to help us. And one of the things that we do give out, we have a feedback line for AfterSight, and it's aftersight.org for the email, or you can call 720-712-8856. We also have a resource list at AfterSight, and we certainly can make, we have some therapists that are on our resource list, and people can reach out and get that information. Thank you, Jeff, for being here. Next week, we'll go on to step two, where we talk about getting ready to turn our lives over to a higher power. And we can all, make our decision as to who or what that higher power is. But it becomes, as Jeff has been saying, we can't do it alone. We have to be ready to give that over to something greater than ourselves to help us move forward. This is Bill Lundgren, and look forward to being with you next week.